So thank you all for coming tonight, and thanks, Ivers, for the nice introduction. Also, I want to thank the MAA for all it does to bring mathematics and its applications to so many people around the world, and especially the country. I think the main, or one of the main messages that I want to convey to you tonight is that math is such a great field to go into, and I know there's a lot of students here, so I'll look over at you guys. It's a great field to go into, and it's taken me places that I never would have thought, intellectually as well as physically. And it's, in the past 2 years, I've gotten involved in a whole new thing, which I hope to tell you more about. So as Ivers said a few times, I flew in from Minnesota this morning, and we have quite a rich history bringing presidents to Washington, D.C. from Minnesota. And if you don't know, these three are the current president of the MAA, and his predecessor and his predecessor are all from Minnesota. So Ken Ross always teases me that it's it should be renamed MAM for the Mathematics Association of Minnesota, but that's not true. Now, we are a rather civic bunch in Minnesota, and in the last presidential election, when I practiced giving this talk in Minnesota, I didn't have the names of the people down, and someone told me I should put them in because no one would know who these people are, and I thought, are you crazy? Okay, good, so you're with me here. In any case, during the last presidential election, which was a large turnout still across the country, only 57% of the people voted. In Minnesota, it was 78%, and many districts reported over 90%. So we're into this. You know, it's a game back there, and all sorts of people get involved, as you may know. Now, Michelle Bachmann, I want to focus on a second, not because she's more interesting than the other two, but because she's one of our congressional representatives, and her district, District 6 in Minnesota, has been significantly changed in the past couple of years, and I'll be talking a lot about this redistricting. So I think it's time to get on to the serious stuff. Oh, I should mention that you probably notice you have a piece of paper with a bunch of R's and D's on it. That's an exercise. Don't do anything yet with it. Keep it. I'll tell you what to do in a little while. So just hold on to it. So over the next 50 minutes or so, I want to indicate to you several places where math and politics intersect. And I will focus, I'm going to give you a little introduction and background, talk about the reapportionment problem, and then really talk a lot about the redistricting problem. And I've lived redistricting for 2 years, as you will hear, both doing theoretical math work and also in the public sphere, which I'll get onto. And then in the last 10 minutes or so, I'll give you a little more about how math and politics interact. So redistricting is the third step in a three-step process. And the first thing we do every 10 years is the census. And that is used to determine the population of the states. And after we do that, the 435 House of Representatives seats are apportioned or allocated out to the states according to the state's population. And then after each state gets its seats, the state has to be carved up into geographic areas, one for each seat. These steps occur every decade, have done since 1790, except for in 1920, which I'll get to. So it's mandated that it happens every 10 years, but you can do these things more often if you want. And you may know that Texas likes to redistrict continuously, more or less. They never stop. So I don't want to say too much about the census, but I'll say just a few words. It is mandated in the Constitution that we do the census to count the people in the United States for the purposes of reapportionment. Now, the census now gathers a lot more information about demographics and whatnot, but it was originally mandated in order to do apportionment of Congress. It contributes to the economy, which is very important right now. So the cost for running the 2010 census was $14 billion, and that's about $40 to $50 per person. And you might want to compare that with China's $1 per person to do their census and India's 40 cents per person to do their census. 800,000 people were employed to do the census, so that it has a big impact on the economy. And then you guys might also be interested to know that the American Statistical Association was basically founded to help with the census. So that's all I'll say about the census. This map here illustrates both reapportionment and redistricting. And I want to draw your attention to a few things. So we've got states like, and I'm at a slightly odd angle here with the pointer, so I'll get used to it. We have states like Montana that have only one seat because their population is so low. And then you can see a couple of single seat states here. Idaho has two seats. I just want to give you an idea how to look at this. I also want to draw your attention to a district like this pink one in Arizona. So it starts at Phoenix and goes up, and then it goes over, okay? And that's not the way you might think to cut up Arizona, most naturally. So we'll talk about why you might do something like that. And, of course, dense population, lots of districts, hard to tell what's going on here. And it's a little unusual to give this talk in D.C. because D.C., of course, has this rather... It's not part of this, really, but, whatever. In any case. And this map helps determine the presidential election outcome. So how do we elect our president? Do we do a popular vote? Well, no. We use this rather eccentric electoral college. And I've been reflecting over the past couple of days about the effects of the storm and what role the Electoral College plays. And I think one could make the argument that this is the Electoral College at its best. No matter how many people in New Jersey come out to vote, they're still going to get the same number of electoral votes. And so maybe that's a good thing. In any case, there are 538, so this is math, so we have an equation up here, 538 electoral votes. Obama or Romney each need 270 to win. And how are those made up? Well, for each of the 50 states, there are two senators, and then there are 435 seats in the House of Representatives, and then that's D.C., okay? And there are electoral votes, but no votes in Congress, those three right there. Okay. So that's what's going on. So we're going to be focusing first on the 435 and how those are divvied up to the states. That's the reapportionment problem. So they're redistributed every 10 years according to the state's population. And you can see that we've used several different methods, four different methods for doing this reapportionment. Jefferson, Webster, and Hamilton are probably the people you're thinking about. Hill and Huntington, the method that we use now at the bottom and have done since 1940, you may not know who they are. Joseph Hill was a chief statistician at the Census Bureau. And I believe Edward Huntington, he was a mathematician, and he taught at both Williams and Harvard, but I think probably being here, I should mention that he's a founding member of the MAA and was the third president of the MAA. He was also vice president of the AMS and vice president of the AAAS at various times in his life. So he did a lot. In the next few slides, I want to show you how two methods work. The Hamilton method, I want to show you that because it was actually the first one proposed, even though it didn't get used at the beginning. And it's the one you might come up with if I gave you the assignment to go home and figure out how to do it. You'd probably come up with it. My students just come up with that method. And then Hill-Huntington because it's what we use now. So I want to introduce you to both of these. So let's look at the original first reapportionment, so 1790. And I know this will take you a few minutes to look at. So I've got the 15 original states, their populations. And then there were 105 seats. So there were not 435, there were 105 at the beginning. And the first thing that we do is we figure out the quota. This column has the quota. And the quota is the exact number of seats that a state would deserve if it got its proportion according to its population. So Virginia should have 18.31 seats. But these are people, right? I mean, you can't have 18.31 seats. So the question becomes, how do we round that number? Should we round it to 18? Should we round it to 19? What should we do? And what Hamilton suggested was to take all these quotas, round them down, and if you do that, you'd, of course, have 18, 13, 12, 10, and so on. You'd add up those numbers, and what would happen? You'd have a problem. You might not have given out 105 seats. And as it turns out, you'd have the blue number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 seats that you still need to dole out. And you look through these numbers, and you look at the largest fractional part. So which state has the largest fractional part? Is it South Carolina?
Kentucky.
Oh, where's Kentucky? Oh, okay, thanks. So Kentucky has the biggest, so they get an extra seat. And you do that in order until you've given out the rest of them. And this is quite a natural idea. And Hamilton proposed that. The Senate and Congress passed it, and it was brought to George Washington, President Washington, and he vetoed it. And it's nice trivia that it was the first presidential veto ever. And he went to his friend Thomas Jefferson, who also had an idea. Jefferson came up with these numbers, and the only place they differ is at the top and the bottom. Okay? Now, you might, of course, know that both Washington and Jefferson are from Virginia, and that's probably what was behind his switching. We doubt that Washington knew that there was a mathematical problem with Hamilton's method. But I do want to tell you what that mathematical problem is. So we're going to look at an easier example where this is a made-up example, of course. So I have states rather creatively named A, B, C, and D. They've got these very nice populations. And I've got 54 seats I want to dole out. So I do the quota thing, figure out the quota, give 21, 18, 8, and 5 seats, discover I've given out only 52 seats. I need to give out two more. Largest fractional part, state D gets another seat. Largest fractional part, second largest fractional part, state C gets another seat. You guys with me? Sort of? Okay. What happens if we increase the house size to 55? What would you expect to happen? What do you want to happen?
Give another one to B.
Give another one to B? Okay. Good. Good idea. Okay. Well, of course, you have to recompute the quotas, right? And when you do that, it turns out that that's not what's going to happen. And you can sort of stare at this and see that this is the new apportionment. So, yeah. So the house size went up, and state C actually lost a seat, and no one's population changed, and the number of states didn't change. That's not good, okay? Or it's not considered good. Let's put it that way. I was going to say something, but I'll skip that. So this problem we would, sorry?
It's not considered good to have a politician. Maybe find a politician.
Correct. Yes. That's right. So this problem, according to mathematicians, we'd rather avoid it. And it's known as the Alabama paradox. And the paradox arises when the number of seats increases, but the number of states and their population stay exactly the same, and a state loses a seat. And this first was identified or observed, I guess I should say, in 1880, when they were using the Hamilton method. They were looking to increase the house size, and Alabama would get 8 seats if there was a 299-person house, and only 7 seats if there was a 300-person house. So it's called the Alabama paradox. Okay, now, when we started out talking about the Hamilton method, it's a question of whether we want to round down those quotas or round up those quotas. And when we think about rounding, how would you normally round? If you have a number between two integers, you would round to the closest integer. In other words, you'd take the arithmetic mean of those two numbers, their average, and see which side it's on. The Hill-Huntington method uses, instead of the arithmetic mean, the geometric mean, okay, which is a nice mean. And that number is in the bottom here, the square root of an integer times its successor. So k times k plus 1, and the square root is the geometric mean. Okay, so this will take a little while. If you haven't seen this before, this will be it might take a few minutes here. So we have the same states, We have the same populations. And the first thing we do, you might know that there's a federal law that every state has to have one representative. So we give everybody one. Okay? Then we compute what's called the first priority number. And how that comes about is you take the population, 15,000, and you divide by that number times it plus 1 and the square root of that. So you take the state population, 1 times 1 plus 1. So in other words, 15,000 divided by square root 2 is that number. Okay, and you do that for all the states. The one with the biggest priority number gets another seat. Okay, now, next round. Do it again. Well, the priority numbers for these stay the same. This changes because we're doing, instead of this 15,000 divided by the square root of 1 times 2, we're doing the 15,000 divided by the square root of 2, 2 plus 1. So this is 15,000 divided by the square root of 6. Did that make sense? Okay. You compute those. Largest one gets another seat. And you keep doing that until you've given out every single seat, and there were 54, and this is the final apportionment. This is blue because it got the last seat. State C got the last seat. And Minnesota got the last seat in the recent round of redistricting. So, and we really didn't think that was going to happen, actually. So that was fun for us. Everybody okay? Okay, that was a little computational for this. It always takes the same number because you give out one at a time. So there'd be 50 given out, and then, like, I guess 435 minus 50 or something like that, right? Yeah.
I'm still stuck back on that first method. I'm just
okay.
Wondering why you would want to increase the number of seats if the population stays the same.
Okay, that's a great question. And so this question about what is a good house size, we'll talk about later. Okay, so there are reasons you might, like, the United States might want to increase their house size, our house size. Yeah?
The Hill-Huntington method, is this a closer approximation to one person, one vote? Does it get closer to equalizing? It does.
And I'll say something about that also in a minute. Okay, so, and it is considered, like, the fairest method by a couple of measures that I'll give you a reference for, and then we could talk about after if you want to. Okay, so this Hill-Huntington method does avoid the Alabama paradox, but it actually can fail what's called the quota rule. So remember Virginia's quota was 18.31? So we probably all think that Virginia should get 18 or 19 seats. I mean, does anybody think it should get 20 seats or 16? Okay, so actually Hill-Huntington can mess up in that way. It could award, not the rounded up, or not the floor or ceiling of the quota, and that's a little bit upsetting. In addition to the Alabama paradox, there are two other paradoxes, the population paradox, and this is when a state gains population but it loses a seat, and all that happens there is some other state gained more seats somehow, or sorry, more population. And the first time that was observed was in 1900, and Virginia was the victim. And then there's also the new state paradox, where you add a new state to the union, and an old state gains or loses seats. The first time this was observed was 1907. Oklahoma became a state. New York lost a seat, but Maine actually gained a seat in that process. So I don't know if they're victims. And I suppose we might face this soon because there's a reasonable chance, I suppose, Puerto Rico will become a state, and then we'll have to think about this. You might want a method to obey the quota rule and not fall prey to the Alabama paradox or population paradox or new state paradox. It can't happen. So Belinsky and Young have proved in a wonderful book from 1982, which, by the way, is, if you want to read about why Hill-Huntington is considered the fairest method, that's where I would tell you to go. It's a wonderful book. Any apportionment method that doesn't violate quota rule must produce at least one of the paradoxes, and sort of the converse, that any apportionment method that does not produce a paradox must violate the quota rule. Okay? So there will never be a good method. So if you go back and you look at, okay, we did Jefferson, we did Webster, we did, I forget what came next, Hamilton, yeah. You might wonder why we keep cycling through. Well, why don't we just choose the best method and stick with it? Well, that's not possible. And there are other methods that are discussed from time to time, and they've never been used, but there's lots of other methods that are in the play. So every 10 years the states shift, and you may be familiar with this picture. This is the last. After the last census, so Texas has to add 4 districts. Yeah.
Who makes the decision? Who made the decisions about which methods to use over the years? Was it Congress?
Yes. Yep. And in fact, in 1920, the reason why there was not an apportionment done was because they could not decide on a method. They argued and argued, and they never settled it. Yeah. It means that if your quota is between, like Virginia had its quota 18.31, that you would either get 18 seats or 19. It can't award 20 or 17. Okay. So after the last after the last reapportionment, Texas has to, for example, add 4 new districts. But even states like Colorado? Is that Colorado? Even a state like Colorado that has the same number of seats, they still have to redistrict because the population has moved around. So this brings us to redistricting, we thought we had one problem, so we'll just, move on from that to another problem. Okay, so now each state has its share of the 435 seats, and how should the state be carved up into its congressional districts? And who's in charge of this, and why should this be so difficult? Seems like never-ending fun. Okay, well, when the redistricting is done, there are 3 criteria that are mandated for every single state. Equal populations, so the one person, one vote. Contiguity, so to mathematicians, that means path connectedness, and that basically means the thing isn't in 2 bits, okay? And then compactness. Now, what does that mean? Well, we'll talk about that. Okay. yeah. Okay. So the equal populations ruling was made in 1964 in the Reynolds versus Sims case. And again, Alabama was sort of at the center of attention. Alabama had not redistricted since 1900. Okay, and the smallest district had 6,700 people, and the largest had 104,000. So there was a case brought that they needed to redistrict, and Chief Justice Warren wrote the 8-1 decision that there should be equal populations in the district. Okay, so now it's time for the exercise. So this room is good because it has a natural division. You guys on the right, Republicans. Okay? On the left, you're Democrats. Okay. So I hope you all have a piece of paper, and if you don't, I have some extras. But that's 6 pictures of the same state, and I'll put it up here also. Oh, I can do that. You have 36 people in your state, and you have 6 copies of the state in case you mess up. Okay? There's Republicans and Democrats. You can see how they're spread around. Your job is to make 4 districts. Got that? 4 districts. You want as many as you can for your party. So you guys try to make as many as you can Republican. You guys try to make as many as you can Democrat. And you want to abide by or obey these 3 criteria here. Okay? So I'll give you a few minutes to do that. I hope you have something to write with. Oh, okay. I think we should move on. I guess you can... Don't work too much, but Okay, so I'm going to ask you some yes-no questions. Are your four districts, do they have equal population? These are yes-no questions, okay? Do your four districts have equal populations?
Yes.
Okay, are they contiguous?
Yes.
Okay, are they compact?
Not at all.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, I think, well, my point here is this is an easy question to answer. Okay, this is an easy question to answer. You don't know what I mean. I mean, what do I mean by that? We don't really know. Okay, so let's sort of move along. So each state is told they have to make compact districts. But what does that mean? And each state is kind of on its own to decide what that means. Okay. And, okay, so these three measures, I want to start telling you about measures that are actually used by the different states. And these three measures are used by several states, including Minnesota, which I'll talk about in a minute. And I just want to tell you what they are. Okay, so the Rook measure. You take the area of the district and divide by the area of the smallest enclosing circle. Okay? And the Polsby-Popper measure, you take the area of the district and take the perimeter of that district, stretch it into a big circle or whatever kind of circle it is, and that'll have some area, divide by that area. And then the population circle, you can see up there, you take the district population and divide by the approximate population of the smallest enclosing circle. Okay, let's look at this shape. How would this do with the Rook measure? Pretty good, actually. It was a little challenge to draw, but it's supposed to look pretty good. Polsby-Popper, it's terrible. Okay, if you take the perimeter of this thing and make a circle, the circle's huge, isn't it? So it does really poorly. And then population circle, we actually have no idea because we don't know where the people live. If all the people live in the gray area and this white is like a moat or something, or a river, you know, that'd tell us one thing or the opposite. So we really can't tell anything. These measures every single value is between 0 and 1. They all give 1 to a circle. And a circle is somehow considered ideal. Now, I've had several interesting conversations about why a circle would be considered ideal when, if you imagine covering a state with circles, it might not be such a good idea. Okay, so as I said, I've kind of lived and breathed redistricting for the past couple of years, and I was on the Minnesota Citizens Redistricting Commission, which I'll come back to in a little while, that was charged with coming up with some maps. Minnesota, almost exactly a year ago, there was a court order that required that any districting plan require inclusion of measures of compactness reports. And these reports had to have the Rook measure, the Schwarzburg measure, whatever that is, perimeter, all these measures. The thing to notice is there's 8 of them, okay? And fine. So I was the only one on this districting commission that had any knowledge of what any of these things would mean, and so I sort of set out trying to figure out what was going on. And there were two plans submitted, a Republican plan, Hippert's plan, and a Democratic plan, Dub Martin. And if you look at these three measures that I described before, they rate equally good with the Rook measure. This one, the Martin, is a little better with Polsby-Popper, and Hippert's a little better with the population circle. I mean, does this tell us anything at all? These are pictures of the Twin Cities. And I wanted to go back to Michelle Bachmann. So this district is her district. This is the Hippert plan for the Twin Cities area. This is the Martin plan for the Twin Cities area. And you can see they're quite different, the two plans. And back at home, this is considered, well, it's just an interesting district. Okay, so if a state does specify measures, how many should they specify? I mean, does 8 seem a reasonable number? Does 1 seem a reasonable number? It's a little hard to know. And, yeah?
Are those following county lines? They seem to be following the same lines.
They do try to follow, we do try to follow county lines, yeah. So in addition to the three Supreme Court mandated criteria, there's all sorts of other criteria, and one is called obeying existing political boundaries. So you don't want to cut a city in two. I mean, a big city you have to, but like a small, like Rochester, Minnesota or something, not a very big place. But you don't want to divide a city in two. You want to keep counties together. Okay, so you want to try to obey other existing things. So they often are following county, some county lines here. Okay. And then the other question is, if these measures are specified by a state, should they be specified in advance of the plan drawing or after? I mean, if you know the measure and you're sort of savvy, you can make your plan look good with respect to that. Next question, why all this focus on measuring compactness? Well, as you probably know, non-compactness really signals that gerrymandering has taken place. And this political cartoon on the left, is that the left to you guys? I think it's the left, okay, is from an 1812 Boston Gazette cartoon, and it depicts a district that was manipulated by then-Governor Elbridge Gerry. And his name is pronounced Gerry, and I don't know why it's not called gerrymandering, but that's just what it is. And gerrymandering is basically considered the intentional manipulation towards some electoral outcome. And measures of compactness can prevent or detect that gerrymandering has taken place. So one might ask, you know, what does make a good measure? If we want to use measures, what makes a good measure? What else could be an ingredient? And I've been thinking for quite a while that map drawers in Maryland have a harder time than the Iowa map drawers. And it's not fair to compare the compactness measure of districts in Maryland to those in Iowa. It's just not fair. Also, you might want to look at the distribution of the population within the district. So these are two ingredients that maybe hadn't been considered too much before. I'm going to focus on the first of these, the shape of the state. So before I turn to mathematics and some toy examples, I want to talk about some real-life examples to prove that these exist. So this is the rather naughty Illinois District 4. And it's shaped like a C. It's connected along the highway where there are no houses. Okay. And I want to point out another couple of things along your observation about things following county lines. You'll notice that they're sort of jagged in a certain way when you look at these districts. That's because they're composed of census blocks, which are the smallest blocks. I mean, not city blocks, they're called census blocks, but they often have a square-ish shape to them. And these census blocks cover the entire United States, water included. And that's because other things abide by redistricting, having to do with water sources and soil districts and all sorts of stuff, so not just people. There's a lot of these. So, for example, Massachusetts, and I don't know why I picked Massachusetts, but Massachusetts has 150,000 census blocks, so just to give you an idea. Many of the districts actually have population zero. Yeah?
Are blocks the same as tracts?
No. One is made up of the other. Well, it must be that tracts are made up of blocks, because blocks are the smallest. Yeah, they're not the same. Okay, and then, so this is one, what I call a C-shaped district, and here's another one. But probably the map drawers here, you know, they didn't really have a choice. Or they did fine. They did better than the map drawers in Illinois, I would argue. Yeah, good, you agree with me. Okay, so a few years ago, he'd be mortified to know this, but this is one of my students. I'll be sure to point this out to him. He was an honors student of mine last year, and he was a double major in math and political science, and he's now teaching at a private school in St. Paul. I set him out to survey existing measures of compactness and their classification, and this is not new. And then I asked him to develop a new measure, or I wanted with him to develop a new measure that considers both the state shape and the population distribution. And we sort of had Illinois 4 in the back of our mind, so just to remember, okay, Illinois 4. And neither of us is a terribly good programmer. This is our picture. We started simple. We did. I mean, it got better. It got really good. And we have very fancy Mathematica drawn districts, but this was simple. So this is supposed to be a C-shaped district. The squares are census blocks. The population is in each of them. And the gray is the state and blue is water. So when we look at these four districts, here's a city up here. Out of these four, we thought this one should score best. If you use those existing measures, they always score the same, as you'll see in a second. So now comes the hardest slide mathematically. Okay, so what we did, so we've got, well, maybe I should just read this one. The district is called D, it's in a state S, and it's made up of K census blocks. It's got a total population, the district does, population P. We let BI be the ith census block with population little pi and geometric center xi. And then what we did was we measured the shortest distance from one geographic center to the other that totally stays in the district, and then the one that totally stays in the state. And you'd want that to be one. The ratio of those. You'd want them to be the same, or we wanted them to be the same. So we considered the ratio right there, and we'd want that to be one, and then we weighted it by population. Okay, that had to do with the distribution of population. And that's our measure, and it rewards every convex district with a one, by the way, just to say. So, and that could be good or bad, depending on how you think. Okay, so Corcoran is my student's last name, and then some of the other measures we were talking about before. The point on this slide is that ours is the only one that gives different numbers, different scores to the four districts. It gives these map drawers a perfect score, which we wanted to do, and the other measures all stay the same. Okay, so let's go back to the exercise. How many of you were able to get four districts for your party? No, you told me you couldn't. Okay. It's impossible, right? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You can think about how many people you need to convert to your side to be able to do it. That's a little exercise. How many people could get three of their party? Okay, good. Two? Got two. Okay, if you draw, well, yeah. Okay, so I did this. So there's my version for each of them. Three Democratic seats, three Republican seats. They're contiguous, equal populations. I think they look pretty compact. I felt pretty good about that. So if I can do this, this begs the question of who actually draws the congressional lines. And now it, of course, gets interesting. Well, in 37 states, it's up to the state legislature. Okay? Well, okay. In two states, there are politician commissions, but not legislators. And then four states have independent commissions. And then the remaining seats only have one district. So they don't have to work very hard. They don't have to do anything. Okay. So let's see here. What would be some alternatives to this? Well, the three most commonly suggested alternatives are a panel of retired judges, citizens' commissions, which do exist, and then computers. And when people talk about computers doing this, they're referring to, if you know about this, you know, great, split-line algorithms or Voronoi diagrams. Those are two common ways to do this. Politically, not very satisfying, but or maybe so. It depends on your point of view. Citizens Commission, this is what I did for the past couple of years, and I can see the time back there. So for the last part of the talk, I want to talk about my personal involvement in a couple of things over the past 2 years. So, as I said, I served on this redistricting commission, and let me tell you a bit about this. So there were 15 of us. We were from all over the state. there are 8 districts in Minnesota, and we were 2 from every district, 1 from only one, one from one district. And we had 2 primary goals, and one was to draw maps through a fair, open, and participatory process, and the other was to sort of serve as a model for the process. And as I mentioned at the beginning, Minnesota is a very active voting place. You know, we like to do this. It's fun. And there were a lot of people that thought that in Minnesota we could sort of set a model for something. Who knows what happened with that? But anyways, we were chosen to represent all parties, all political views. We had widespread of ages, widespread of everything you could think of. When we got in the room, well, our ages were pretty obvious, but we weren't supposed to tell what political party we cared about or anything. Of course, by the end of our year together, yeah, you could tell some, but there were about half the people where you actually couldn't tell. And it was incredibly interesting work. It took a long time. I mean, we started out with education. So, like, the state demographer came and gave us a lecture, like a 4-hour lecture. And we'd have these 10-hour marathon meetings on Saturdays. And then sometimes we'd have meetings 5 to 10 on Wednesday evening. You know, it was great. It was a lot of fun. But I learned a ton. You know, we also held public hearings around the state, 2 in each district. And there was a lot of negotiating and designing criteria. So in addition to the 3, we had 6 or 7 other criteria that we used to draw our maps. And then, of course, there was news interviewing that we got involved with. And then the last thing I want to talk about is a course that I am enjoying teaching right this second, and I'm not going to teach tomorrow because I'll be here still. But for the past decade or so, I've taught various versions of this course, but I have the joy right now of team teaching it with a political scientist, and it is great. And in addition to reapportionment and redistricting, I want to tell you some of the other questions that we consider in the class. So there are a lot of emerging democracies in the world, like Iraq and Nepal, and the question becomes, well, if you're going to start a democracy, what's the electoral system going to look like? How are you going to elect who are your politicians going to be, and how are you going to choose them? And the electoral systems used around the world, there's a lot of them, and they fall broadly into these categories, and this FPTP, that's us, first past the post. The first to get 270 electoral votes wins the presidency. That's us. Iraq uses this, list proportional representation. This is another interesting one that we talk about in my class, single transferable voting, which is instant runoff voting, which a lot of Americans, or not a lot, but American cities are starting to use. Instant runoff voting is when you just want one winner, so a mayor or a president. Single transferable voting is the same process, but where you want, like, a school board. You want 5 people to be chosen to win or something like that. So in my class, we go through how these various systems work, and students get to choose a country and look into this, and it's rather fun. Talking about house size, so I was asked earlier, why would you want to increase your house size if the population stayed the same? So what does make a good house size? Why do we have 435? So this is kind of a complicated picture, the lower one. This upper picture is the Indian parliament. We have 435 representatives in our lower house. The average district size is 710,000 people. So that's about one representative per 710,000 people. At the extremes are India, which has a 552-seat lower house. That's about 2 million people per representative. Okay. Hungary, at the other extreme, has 386 people house, and that's about 26,000 people per seat. And on this little graph here, that's India. Okay, first of all, this is the population in millions. This is the assembly size, lower house. There's India. There's Hungary. There we are. What would be a good house size? Well, one model says that it should be the cube root of the population. And that's the population of the United States on Sunday. according to, you know, something on the internet. And it would, that model says that we should have a 680 member house, okay? The same model would give Hungary a 215 seat house and India a 1,063 person house. Now, you can start seeing the problems. That's the Indian Parliament building. Where are those 1,063 people going to sit? And how can you imagine working in a meeting with 1,000 people? It'd be tough. So there are constraints. And it's a really interesting student project, by the way, to read about this model. It's a several variable optimization problem that's not that hard. I mean, it's hard, but it's not out of hand. Okay. Next thing, okay, if you have your parliament or your house, should you have thresholds or should you have quotas? And let me explain what those are. So Turkey, for example, Turkey, has a threshold, meaning that a party has to win 10% of the vote to get any seat. So if your party's listed and you only get 3%, sorry, no seats. You have to get 10%. Turkey has the highest threshold. Iraq has a quota. And that means, and as an example, 25% of their seats have to be held by women. And we of course have no such thing. We have geographic representation, and that's it. Okay. What about ballot design? Okay. So here is the Egyptian ballot from 2011. There are over 40 parties and 100 independent candidates represented. They get a little picture. So there's a strawberry. And what else? There's like palm trees and glasses, sunglasses. So, and the reason why is because 30% of the population is illiterate. So you go in, you know, you look for your picture. Well, maybe you don't have a picture pre-chosen. You go in and you're thinking, I want a strawberry. I don't want that square, whatever that thing is. And then there's some historically motivated ones. You know, maybe you feel very nationalistic or something. So the pictures do something. And before I turn to the next ballot, I'll show you one more ballot. But there are other things that are stand out about different voting systems. So, for example, does a country get a day off of work to go vote? You know, with this, we don't, but most countries do. What about fines for not voting? In Australia, you're fined if you don't vote, okay? So those are, you know, interesting things. Oh, and what about literacy tests? We used to have a literacy test. We don't anymore. And then this is a sample ballot that maybe some of you will be using next Tuesday. It's coming soon. So I'll just draw your attention here. I don't know any of these people. But they're not in alphabetical order, are they? And what order are they in? Random, one hopes, yeah. So it matters a lot. I mean, there are many statistical studies that show that people at the top get way more votes than people at the bottom, even if you have no idea who they are. Okay, we get tired of reading. So ballot design it plays a big role in these things. And I think finally, so I'm just about done here, on the last slide I've given you two links, and I understand you'll be able to see these slides. So these are really fun and informative, I might say. This is just a 3-minute long song, but you'll learn a lot if you watch it. And this game, you could spend hours playing, and you should. you'll learn a ton about redistricting. So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to talk about anything else for a while.